to introduce Rachel Briggs, who's going to be joining us in the Centre for Time very soon, next month. And Rachel's going to be talking to us about indicatives, counterfactuals, truth and probability, which just about wraps it up.
Yeah, I was worried that the topic was too narrow. All right. This is going to end up being a talk about the Ramsey test. And good. Can everybody hear me all right? Good. So this is going to end up being a talk about the Ramsey test, which is an idea inspired by this footnote by Ramsey. So here's what Ramsey says about conditionals. I'll just let you guys read that rather than reading it out loud to you. A sort of appealing and influential idea about conditionals. Here's kind of... Oh. All right. Right. So if two people are arguing, if P then Q, and are both in doubt as to P, then they are adding P hypothetically to their stock of knowledge and arguing on that basis about Q. So that in a sense, if P Q and if P not Q are contradictories, we can say that they are fixing their degree of belief in Q given P. If P turns out false, these degrees of belief are rendered void. If either party believes not P for certain, then the question ceases to mean anything to him except as a question about what follows from certain laws or hypotheses. So that's the Ramsey test. Here is my sort of rephrasing of the Ramsey test that I think captures what is a very general idea. So for any individual, the acceptability of a conditional, if A then B, is the degree to which she would accept the proposition that B on the supposition that A, provided that A is epistemically possible for her. So, and then there are various accounts of conditionals, all of which I think are cashings out of the Ramsey test. And I will talk about those accounts and different kinds of conditionals and why you'd want to unify various cachings out of the Ramsey test, and why you'd want to also have unified accounts of different types of conditionals. So, big picture, cashing out the Ramsey test, and cashing out the Ramsey test for various kinds of conditionals, which I will talk about now. Oh, sorry. So first I've got two approaches to the Ramsey test. So one general approach involves conditional probabilities. So the according to this approach, the acceptability of a conditional is to be defined in terms of conditional probabilities. So the acceptability of the conditional, if A then B, is to be defined in terms of conditional probabilities involving A and B. And sort of canonically, the conditional probability that you use is just the probability of B conditional on A. That's one popular approach. Another popular approach is a truth conditional approach, where you talk not about the degree to which I ought to accept a conditional, but the actual truth value of the conditional. And that, according to the truth conditional approach, is determined by the truth value of the consequent at the closest possible world where the antecedent is true. So I want to know whether if A then B is true. I sort of go to the closest possible world where A is true, and I check whether B is true. So those are two kind of appealing approaches. I'll talk a little bit more about why they're appealing in the body of the talk. And you might like to put them together, but there's going to be trouble. So, okay, that's two approaches to the Ramsey test that I'd like to unify. And now we're on to kinds of conditionals. So I'm going to talk as though there are three kinds of conditionals. This is a pretty rough categorization, and I would appreciate sort of help from anybody with more linguistics expertise than me. So people usually like to contrast indicative counterfactuals. So canonical example, if Oswald didn't shoot Kennedy, someone else did, with counterfactual conditionals. Sort of canonical example, if Oswald hadn't shot Kennedy, someone else would have. So these conditionals pretty clearly mean different things. In order to believe the first one, you just have to believe that there's sort of lots of evidence that somebody shot Kennedy. And that evidence would sort of persuade you that somebody shot Kennedy, even if you learned that Oswald hadn't. The second one, you have to believe sort of more than that. You have to believe that there was kind of some kind of conspiracy, so that even if Oswald hadn't shot Kennedy, somebody else would have. So the evidence required for you to accept those two conditionals is different, and they seem to mean different things. So that's some reason to believe that they're sort of two different kinds of conditionals, because the component sentences are exactly the same. There's also, a note about counterfactuals. They are often causal, but they're not always necessarily causal. So an example of a non-causal counterfactual is, if we'd had libertarian free will, then the laws of nature would have been very different than they in fact are. So that looks like it's a counterfactual. It's got the counterfactual grammar, but it's not about what would have caused what. Also, here's a third type of conditional, such that I'm, it's not exactly clear where it fits into the scheme. Predictive. Imagine somebody uttering before the Kennedy assassination, if Oswald doesn't shoot Kennedy, somebody else will. So is that the future tense of the first one or the future tense of the second one? It's not clear. And I'm actually going to assume that it's ambiguous between an indicative reading and a counterfactual reading. And I'll have a little bit of evidence to back that up. So good. So those are three kinds of conditionals. Now, why might you want a unified approach of those to those three kinds of conditionals? They seem to have a lot of commonalities. So they typically validate the same rules. So all three of them validate modus ponens. So I say, if Oswald didn't shoot Kennedy, somebody else did. He didn't shoot Kennedy, therefore somebody else did. So that seems like a valid inference. Also, sort of, if Oswald hadn't shot Kennedy, somebody else would have. Suppose I believe that. I come to believe Oswald didn't shoot Kennedy. I continue to believe that if he hadn't shot Kennedy, somebody else would have. Then I should infer that somebody else shot Kennedy. And if I say, if Oswald doesn't shoot Kennedy, somebody else will, and then I learn that that Oswald, sort of, time passes, I learn that Oswald didn't shoot Kennedy, somebody else does. I learn that Oswald didn't shoot Kennedy, I keep believing the original predictive conditional, it seems like I should conclude that somebody else has shot Kennedy. So they all validate modus ponens. They all validate entailment and the consequent. So if B entails C, then if A then B entails if A then C. I'm going to go over these a little bit faster because there's more I want to get to. In addition to validating the same rules, they also invalidate the same rules. So they invalidate contraposition. So if A then B does not necessarily entail if not B, then not A for any of these three kinds of conditionals. So I say if we had taken the car, it wouldn't have broken down in relation to a trip on which we didn't take the car. This does not entail that if the car hadn't broken down, we wouldn't, or if the car had broken down, we would not have taken it. Maybe it would have broken down because we had taken it. So, contraposition, antecedent strengthening. So, if A then B, it does not in general entail if A and C then B for arbitrary C for either indicatives or counterfactuals, and both of them invalidate transitivity. So, if A then B and if B then C do not necessarily entail if A then C. So I'm going to give you those as data, and you can ask me more about them in the Q&A. So all of them seem to have, all three types of conditionals seem to validate the same rules, invalidate the same rules. You might think they ought to have the same underlying logic. So you might like a unified account of them. So good. That's the overview. Now I'm going to look at the conditional probability approach in a bit more detail. So here's an intuitive example of why the conditional probability approach seems right. I draw a card from a randomly shuffled deck. How likely should you find the following conditional? If the card is a face card, that is a jack, queen, or king, then it's a jack. So meditate for a moment on that conditional. I say, it's about one-third likely, of course. You know, one-third of the face cards are jacks. Put the reasoning a little bit more formally, my credence that it's a jack given that it's a face card, which is equal to my credence that it's a jack and a face card divided by my credence that it's a face card, is 1/3. So, look, acceptability of conditional just sort of goes with conditional credence. That seems right in this case, at least. So, more generally, the acceptability of a conditional, if A then B, is your credence in B conditional on A. So, I'm going to say acceptability rather than probability for reasons that will become clear if you're not used to them yet. So, good. There are, however, some weird counterexamples to Adam's thesis and an interesting fix to them in terms of conditional probabilities. So, I'm going to go through just two of those counterexamples. So, McGee's counterexample. We have a famous suspicious death case. Murdoch is dead, possibly murdered. Brown is the prime suspect. And you think it's highly likely that Brown's death was an accident. You've been following the case in the papers. You think it's highly unlikely that Brown killed, that Murdoch's death is an accident. You've been following it in the papers. You think it's highly unlikely that Brown killed Murdoch. Because you think it's highly unlikely that anybody killed Murdoch. But you think it's extremely unlikely that anyone other than Brown killed Murdoch, because you think nobody else had motive and opportunity. Now, imagine that against all this background, an informant whom you strongly suspect is Sherlock Holmes tells you the following. I am certain that this is a murder. If Brown didn't kill Murdoch, somebody else did. So, it seems like on the basis of your informant's testimony, since you trust your informant, and he's probably Holmes, you should come to believe that if Brown didn't kill Murdoch, somebody else did. But suppose after hearing the informant's testimony, you were to conditionalize on the proposition that Brown did not kill Murdoch. In this case, you would come to believe that Murdoch's death was an accident, and you'd come to believe that your informant was not Holmes and that you'd been mistaken about his identity. So even though you trust your informant and you believe that if Brown didn't kill Murdoch, somebody else did, you don't have a high conditional probability or conditional credence in the proposition that somebody else killed Murdoch, given that Brown didn't. Because were you to conditionalize on that information, you wouldn't believe the consequence of this, or you don't have kind of a high conditional credence. So it looks like here we've got a conditional whose acceptability doesn't go by the conditional probability, but by something else. So that's kind of weird. I've got another counterexample, which might help to make what's going on a bit clearer. So this is from John Pollock. We've got a vase, call it X very creatively, and it was included in a certain shipment of vases. We know that 75% of these vases were ceramic and highly fragile, and the rest, the other 25%, were plastic and virtually unbreakable. Some of the vases were dropped. Every ceramic vase that was dropped broke, and no plastic vase that was dropped broke, because the plastic ones are very durable and the ceramic ones are not very durable. And when the shipment reached its destination, all the broken vases and all the plastic vases were discarded. Of the discarded vases, 75% were plastic. And throughout this whole story, we don't know whether vase X was ceramic or plastic. So we think probably if vase X was dropped, it broke. So 75% of the vases were ceramic, and the ceramic ones that were dropped all broke. So probably if vase X was dropped, it broke. However, then suppose you learn that vase X was discarded. It looks like you should no longer believe the conditional or accept the conditional probably if the vase was dropped, it broke. Because 75% of the discarded vases were plastic, and we know that the plastic ones if dropped didn't break. But learning that the vase was discarded can't affect your conditional credence in the proposition that it broke given that it was dropped, because all the dropped vases were discarded. So it's just kind of mathematically impossible for this new piece of information to affect your conditional credence. Yet it looks like it ought to affect your acceptance of the conditional. So looks like if we affect your acceptance of the conditional, but not your conditional credence, then we've got an argument that your acceptance of the conditional should not go by your conditional credence. So Stefan Kaufman has a really nice proposal that explains both of these examples, the counterexamples to Adam's thesis, and some other counterexamples besides. So find some background variable x to be held constant. In the Murdoch case, the background variable is going to be just whether your informant is Holmes or not. And in the vase case, it's going to be what the vase is made of, whether it's ceramic or plastic. And then I'm going to call this Kaufman's thesis, because Kaufman asserts it. So where the possible values of x are just x1, x2, xn, the acceptability of the conditional, if a then b, goes by the sum over all the possible values of x. Take each possible value of x, multiply it by your credence in the take each value of x, multiply your credence in it by your credence in the consequent given that value of x and the antecedent, and then add them up. So rephrased in a more intuitive way, compute the acceptability of a conditional in two steps. First of all, for each of a set of background hypotheses that you're going to hold fixed, take the conditional probability of the consequent given the conjunction of the antecedent with that hypothesis. And then take the average of the results from the first step weighted by the initial probabilities of the background hypotheses. So this is a definition of the acceptability of a conditional in terms of conditional probabilities. But it's not just equating the acceptability of the conditional to the conditional probability. It's a little bit more complicated. And that will sort of give you the right behavior for the conditional in both examples. So that looks good. There's an interesting relationship with Adam's thesis. So Adam's thesis can be understood as Kaufman's thesis with a kind of added abductive inference step. So this is Adam's thesis rewritten in terms of the X partition. It's a little bit ugly, so I'm not going to read it through. I'm just going to give you the intuitive gloss. So you can imagine Adam's thesis telling you to compute the acceptability of the conditional, not in two steps like Kaufman's thesis, but in three steps. So step one, for each of a set of background hypotheses, take the conditional probability of the consequent given the conjunction of the antecedent with that hypothesis, just the way you did in the Kaufman's thesis recipe. Next, you have an extra abductive step. That's number two. So to compute the revised weight of the conditional probability associated with the background hypothesis, take the background hypothesis's probability conditional on the antecedent of the conditional. So you're revising your opinion about the background hypothesis, which you didn't have to do in the Kaufman recipe. And then you take a weighted average of of all the conditional probabilities according to the revised weights of the xi's, not their original weights. So it's just like the Adams recipe is just like a Kaufman recipe with this reweighting step thrown in step two. So we've got a story about what's going on in the Adams case as well as in the Kaufman case. So here's a thought about what might be a unified conditional probability approach. You might think the acceptability of an indicative conditional, or a predictive conditional, that's the future tense of an indicative, goes by Adams' thesis. Whereas the acceptability of a counterfactual conditional, or a predictive that's the future tense of that counterfactual, goes by Kaufman's thesis, at least when the antecedent is epistemically possible. And this seems to get the examples right. So we can imagine the following conversation. Murdoch did it after all. So said after the Murdoch mystery case. You say, but in light of what Holmes said, we know that Holmes was right. If it hadn't been Murdoch, it probably would have been somebody else. So there's a counterfactual. It looks like Kaufman's got the story about the acceptability of the counterfactual right. Likewise, in the Pollock case, that discarded vase wasn't dropped after all, you say. We still don't know whether it was plastic or ceramic. You say, but if it had been dropped, it probably wouldn't have broken because it was probably plastic. So those are just two pieces of evidence that Kaufman's thesis gets the right story about counterfactuals and predictives that are the future tenses of counterfactuals. Just the way that Adam's thesis got the right answer in the Jack Queen King case. So another nice thing about this unified conditional probability approach is that Kaufman's thesis is just kind of the same equation that you use to, on one way of doing causal decision theory, compute the counterfactual probabilities of outcomes conditional on your actions. So you take an causally individuated partition. You use Kaufman's thesis to gauge the probability of propositions of the form, if I acted this way, then this good or bad outcome would occur. And then you sort of weight up the expectations that are based on those sort of Kaufman conditional probabilities. So this looks like a nice story about indicatives and counterfactuals in terms of conditional probabilities. Explanatory, helpful, fits in with decision theory, great. So that's the conditional probability approach, and so far things look pretty good. What about the truth conditional approach? What is that, and why is that attractive? So suppose you're trying to decide whether if A, then B. Intuitively, you should think what the world would be like if A were the case, and check whether if the world were like that, B would be the case. So in other words, if A, then B is true to world W, say here, just in case the closest world to W, where A is true, is a world at which B is true. So in other words, the closest A world to W is a B world. And there's intuitive kind of support for what the truth conditional approach does. So the truth conditional approach says just the truth value of if A then B is given by this third bullet point. It turns out to sort of get the logic of conditionals right. So it turns out to make them validate the right principles. So makes them validate modus ponens, makes them validate entailment within the consequent, makes them invalidate the right principles, gives you a very nice logic, and has intuitive motivation. So hurry for the truth conditional approach. You might think there's even a unified truth conditional approach. So Bob Stolniker has proposed this. I think he no longer believes it, but you might think, look, the difference between indicatives and subjunctives is they differ with respect to how closeness is cashed out. So in both cases, closeness is to be cashed out in terms of some similarity relation among worlds. So the closest world to here where A is true is just the world that's most similar to this world, consistently with A being true. But for indicatives, there's sort of an extra constraint on similarity, according to this sort of unified proposal. The closest world to any doxastically or epistemically possible world must also be doxastically or epistemically possible. So when I consider, you say, if Oswald didn't shoot Kennedy, somebody else did. And then I consider, well, what would the world be like if Oswald didn't shoot Kennedy? Given that I'm trying to evaluate an indicative, I have to go to another world that I don't know is not actual. So I have to think about a world such that I don't know I'm not in it. Well, maybe Oswald didn't shoot Kennedy. And what would the world be like if he didn't? For all I know, it might be that way. So that kind of makes intuitive sense as well. So this rule does mean that the propositions expressed by indicative conditionals are going to be context dependent. Change what you know when you change what if A then B means, because you change what it takes for if A then B to be true. So we've got a truth conditional approach. We've got a probabilistic approach. Why not put them together? Why not have a unified approach? So now you know that wasn't a typo. Great, put them together. We know this won't work in the case of indicatives, that we can't have a unified approach. So the trouble is that the following claim can't possibly be true. And this is mostly cribbed from Al Hayek, who I think is, if he's not sitting in the audience, then he will be at some point today. great. Yes, so, yes, cribbed from Al Hayek. I've got, for any probability function P, there is some conditional connective arrow, such that for any two propositions, A and B, if A then B is a proposition, and the probability of if A then B is just the conditional probability of B given A. So that claim cannot possibly be true. That's what you'd want in order to unify the two approaches, because then you'd have sort of truth conditions that just sort of spit you out the right probabilities. And so this is a weaker version than things this is weaker than the strongest version of this thesis that people like to refute. So the quantifier order means that we're allowing the meaning of the conditional to be context dependent. So it doesn't have to be that there's some conditional connective that's invariant in meaning over all probability functions. It just has to be, in order for this to be true, it just has to be that for any probability function, we can find some way of assembling conditional propositions that gets the truth evaluative approach and the probability approach to agree. And we can't have that. So there's a series of ugly results that mean we can't have a unified approach. These are also cribbed from Al Hayek and Ned Hall. So good. So ugly result one, this is Al's result. For any connective arrow, any probability functions, function P and any propositions A and B, such that we get this nice alignment between the truth conditional approach and the probability approach. So where we do have the probability of if A then B equaling the conditional probability of B on A, we can perturb the probability function P. And what perturbation is technical and messy, but you take some probability out of one proposition, you move it around into another proposition, and you can end up with a probability function P prime, such that P prime of if A then B does not equal the conditional probability of B on A. So this is bad because given a probability function that does what we want with respect to any two propositions, we can generate a probability function that fails to do what we want, that fails to sort of unify the two approaches with respect to those two very propositions. So that's ugly. There's a finitude result, also L's. So basically this says that if you've got a probability function that's non-trivial, which means it assigns a probability of other than 1/2 to anything, other than 0, 1, or 1/2 to anything, and you've got finitely many propositions with probabilities, then you can't have it be that for every A and B, the probability of if A then B equals the probability of B given A. So if you've got only finitely many propositions, the upshot is you can't get your conditional probabilities to line up with your probabilities of conditionals for all your propositions. And that looks ugly. There's a no atoms result, which basically says, a probability atom is intuitively a proposition such that it's got non-zero probability, and there's no proposition that's stronger than it that gets between zero and its probability. So it's kind of a proposition that's not subdivisible in terms of probabilities. So if you've got probability atoms, and you've got a conditional connective that validates modus ponens, which presumably you want your conditional connective to do, then again, you can't have your conditional probabilities lining up with your probabilities of conditionals. So basically, if you want any definition of a conditional connective that lines your probabilities of conditionals up with your conditional probabilities, then it has to have infinitely many propositions, and for every proposition that you've got, there has to be a stronger one with probability between the probability of your original proposition and zero. So it's a claim about how rich your space of propositions has to be in order for you to get the two interpretations to line up. So finitude and no atoms mean that you have to have really rich probability spaces in order to get conditionals that have the appropriate probabilities given sort of your story about conditional probability. Constructibility, so under some pretty appealing constraints. You've got a conditional, an arrow that validates modus ponens as you want it to, and entailment within the consequent, which I mentioned up above, which it seems like you also want it to. And if you've got any three disjoint propositions with positive probability, then if you if you can get your conditional probabilities to line up with your probabilities of conditionals, then you can also sort of, for any real number arbitrarily chosen, construct a sentence whose probability is exactly that real number. So that's a little weird. So Hayek and Hall say in a paper about this, look, it makes sense to have sentences that are logically true and logically false, sort of just in virtue of their form. But what would it mean to have a sentence whose probability was 347 over 479 in virtue of its logical form? That's very confusing. So if you want if you want to get the two approaches to conditionals to line up, you have to have very rich probability spaces. You have to have sort of propositions that are logically constrained to have arbitrary real probabilities. This all looks very weird, and of course, there's the perturbation result saying that you can't. You can't have just for arbitrary propositions and arbitrary probability functions these two interpretations lining up. So that's none of that's new to me. That's all sort of pointed out by Al Hayek and Ned Hall, building off work by David Lewis. But one thing that nobody has noticed about these ugly results is that they have ugly corollaries for the Kaufman definition of conditional probabilities. So you might think, look, indicative conditionals are ugly. You cannot get their probabilistic interpretation to line up with their truth evaluative interpretation. But you might at least think that for counterfactuals, the Kaufman interpretation will line up nicely with some truth evaluative interpretation. And in fact, Kaufman suggests this. And Peter Menzies suggested this in something that he never published a long time ago, so I can't really blame him for it. But it turns out that there are further ugly results that show that you can't, just as you can't get your conditional probabilities to line up with your probabilities of conditionals, sort of for indicatives, you can't get them to line up for counterfactuals either, assuming the counterfactuals get the Kaufman interpretation. So I think I'm probably running short on time, so.
You've had 35 minutes so far, so.
Okay.
You've got about another 10, 15.
Okay, good. I'd like to get to the stuff at the end. So I'll just very quickly go through this. So just as there's a perturbation result that says that if you've got any two propositions, A and B, and you've got a probability function that makes the conditional probabilities line up with the probabilities of conditionals, you can create another probability function that makes the conditional probabilities still line up with the probabilities of conditionals. You can do an analogous thing where the conditional probabilities are defined in Kaufman terms instead of in Adams terms. So you can... You have to define perturbations a little bit differently, but you can create a perturbation problem for Kaufman's definition of conditional probability. Also, sort of the Kaufman definition of conditional probability requires there to be infinitely many propositions compatible with each member of your sort of background partition, provided that each member of your background partition is compatible with at least three propositions. So if at least three, then infinitely many. No atoms, so if you've got at least three propositions compatible with any member of your background partition, there can't be any atoms within that member. And constructability. So you can construct sentences with arbitrary probabilities. So these are actually like really easy to prove from the earlier triviality results. All you need to notice is that if you have a Kaufman conditional, then any member of the background partition gives you an embedded probability function that would give you an Adams conditional. So we've got triviality not just for Adams conditionals, but for Kaufman conditionals. So this means basically that it's very hard to line up the conditional probability approach with the truth evaluative approach, even if you use Kaufman's definition of conditional probability instead of Adams' definition. So that's all rather ugly. You might think that you could solve this problem, and this was suggested by Peter Menzies as well in unpublished work, in terms of imaging. So both approaches can be unified by the idea of an imaging function. So let me say what that is. An imaging function takes as its input a possible world W and a proposition A, and it gives you an output. So in the simplest case, the output is just another possible world. So this is the version of the truth conditional approach that I was telling you about. So the closest possible world to W, where A is true, is the output of the imaging function in the simplest case. But you can generalize that. So you might say, in the next simplest case, what the imaging function gives you as an output is not a set of not a single possible world, but a set of possible worlds. So I want to know what the world would be like if A were true, and I'm sort of standing at W. There might be no unique way that the world would be if A were true, but there might be a set of possible ways. So if you give up the idea that there's a unique way that the world would be if A were true, then you can let the imaging function give you as outputs not the single closest possible world where A, but the set of closest possible worlds where A that are sort of tied for closeness. You might build a little bit more information into the imaging function. So in the most sophisticated case, you give me not just a set of closest possible worlds where A, when I'm standing at W and asking you what would happen if A, but you give me a probability distribution over those sets of over that set of worlds. So you say, well, if A were true, then world W1 would be likely to this degree, and world W2 would be likely to that degree. So in the most sophisticated case, the image of world W1A is not just the closest A world, and not the set of closest A worlds, but a probability function over a set of A worlds. So this is a generalization of the truth conditional approach that is not itself truth conditional, but it has the truth conditional approach as its most special case. So imaging and acceptability. You can get a nice definition of acceptability if you've got the notion of an image function. So according to the truth conditional approach, recall, the acceptability of the conditional if A then B should just be your credence in the conditional if A then B. And that's unproblematic because there's a proposition. It's the conditional. It should get your credence. But now, suppose W sub A, B is a function that equals 1 if B is true at the closest A world and 0 otherwise. Then we can just rewrite what I said on the first line there as the acceptability of the conditional if A then B is the sum over members of, sum over different possible worlds of your credence in each possible world multiplied by W sub A of B. So that's just a complicated way of saying your credence in each possible world multiplied by whether or not if A then B is true there, and then add them up. So that should be your credence in if A then B. So more generally, letting our image function give us not just output worlds, but output probability functions over sets of worlds, where W sub A is the probability distribution you get by imaging W on proposition A, the acceptability of if A then B is the sum over all the worlds that you've got of your credence in that world times the image probability of B on A. So that's kind of a nice generalization of the truth conditional approach. Now we're ready to kind of explain Adam's thesis and Kaufman's thesis in terms of imaging. So here's just a restatement of the claim about the acceptability of if A then B in terms of image probabilities. For Adam's thesis, for indicative, we can let, oh dear, let's get an actual. Yes, the first W should not have a prime. So we're going to let the image of A on, and the second, actually, I think either the second W should not have a prime or the third W should have a prime. And, so let me just say this in English, what this is supposed to mean, because I've fouled up the formalism slightly. So for indicatives, let the image probability So say I'm standing at a world W, and I want to know what the probability of W prime is would be if A. What I do is I just take my my conditional credence in W prime given A. So I let image probabilities be determined by conditional credences. This means that, in some sense, the meaning of if A then B will be context dependent, because the image probability of B on A will depend on what I already believe about sort of various conditional probabilities. Had I written the formalism correctly, this would have. Yes. So, define the image probabilities correctly in terms of conditional credences, and you just get Adam's thesis to fall out. Likewise, for Kaufman's thesis, you say, say I've got a world, and I've got my background partition. Just let X sub W be the member of the background partition that holds a world W. And then for counterfactuals, we can let, and I've written this one correctly, the image probability on A of W prime at W. So I'm standing at W, and I'm saying, all right, if A were true, how likely would W prime be? Well, I take the conditional credence of W prime, not just on A, but on A to, conjoined with the right member of the background partition. So I take, yes. And that together with the definition of acceptability will give you that the acceptability of a counterfactual goes with Kaufman's thesis. So we've no longer got truth conditions for indicatives and counterfactuals, but we've got some extension of the idea of truth conditions. And if we use the extension of the idea of truth conditions instead of the truth conditions, then we can get Adam's thesis and Kaufman's thesis to hold. For Kaufman's thesis, too, the meaning of if A then B will be context-dependent, because the image probabilities of various worlds are going to depend on your conditional credences, conditional on members of the partition. But plausibly, we've got an appropriately causal partition, so we've got a causal counterfactual, the principle is going to require that there be a sort of systematic relationship between your conditional credence and sort of the objective conditional probability. So that may constrain exactly how context dependent any appropriately causal counterfactual is if you've got Kaufman's thesis. So good. That's the suggestion for a unified approach. So some outstanding questions for the unified approach would be, first of all, how much of the spirit of the truth conditional approach does the imaging approach preserve? So it's an extension of the truth conditional approach. So, imaging probabilities are extensions of truth conditions. But it's not immediately obvious sort of how much of the good of truth conditions you get out of image probabilities, especially given the context dependence. So yeah. Next question, how problematic is the context sensitivity of the imaging approach? And you might think that depends on how extensive its context sensitivity is, and that will differ from between indicatives and counterfactuals, because with counterfactuals, you've at least got the principle. It's a constraint. And finally, I haven't said anything about what to do about conditionals with epistemically impossible antecedents. So this has all been following Ramsey's suggestion that we restrict our consideration of conditionals to those with antecedents that might, for all you know, be true. So that's the unified approach and some outstanding questions. So, good. So there are two issues. Epistemically impossible is not having credence zero, and I agree with you about that. And second issue, what about things with where there's no well-defined conditional credence? So in response to the first issue, a bit more, the problem for things that have credence zero, for conditionals with antecedents that have credence zero, is going to be that there's going to be some trouble about how to define conditional credences on propositions with credence zero. And you know, there are perfectly mathematically acceptable ways to define conditional credences. The question is, how do we figure them out from your current beliefs and dispositions? So there's a slide between credence zero and epistemically impossible, and there's also a slide between credence zero and no well-defined conditional credence. So one way to sort of remedy that problem is to say that, look, things that have credence zero, or sorry, things that are actually epistemically impossible, as well as having credence zero, are things such that I have no well-defined conditional credences on them. So if something is epistemically possible for me, it might receive credence zero, but I can tell you what I believe would happen if it were the case. And that's what it is for me to consider an epistemic possibility, or what it is that you know might happen if it were to be the case. Whereas if it gets non-zero credence, then I don't have any well-defined conditional credences. So that's an option to sort of fix two problems at once.
Mm-hmm. And so the probability of A subscript B is mm-hmm. And when A is a probability zero or is indeterminate probability, then you cannot have the ratio definition.
Right.
So that's a way, I mean, to make it more general, then you say the case in which the probability is definite, not zero, then you get the ratio.
Yeah, no, I think you're I'm not going to defend the ratio definition. So I think I'm persuaded by everybody who thinks that look, the ratio claim is a constraint on conditional probabilities and unconditional probabilities in their relationship, and not a definition of conditional probability. So I accept that point. And I'm not sure what to do about cases where there's no well-defined conditional probability.
Oh.
Yes.
Which, by the way, I think are very pretty results.
Yes, no offense.
Looks like you've got some pretty results too against Kaufman, so that's really mm-hmm. cool. I thought I'd say just something more about the finiteness result, and I think the trouble that it causes for Adam's thesis as well as the probabilities of conditionals thesis.
Oops.
So for a start, it can be good, right? So that can be strengthened. It isn't. This is true, but it isn't just the problem with finite in any. Just having a finite ranged probability function is bad enough, because in such cases there'll just be too many conditional probabilities to go around. There'll be wallflowers. There'll be values you just can't possibly get on the left-hand side, which you can get on the right-hand side. So they'll be the counterexamples. Okay, now consciousness, so the left-hand side becomes acceptability. So it seems like that's a sort of more nebulous target. I mean, we don't have the acceptability calculus. It's not like
right.
the theorems of acceptability. But still, it'll be a related problem. So the only way the Adams thesis stated in terms of acceptability could be correct would be if acceptability was really fine-grained. Because remember, you don't want there to be any wallflowers. It has to match up with all the values on the right-hand side. And we know that probability is not sufficiently fine-grained to do that. Okay? So acceptability, somehow mysteriously, would have to be more fine-grained than probability so that the left-hand side could keep up with the right-hand side and there would never be any stray values that you couldn't match. And that seems rather odd to me, how acceptability could be so much more fine-grained than probability.
No, that's a fair question. I think I was kind of trying to see things in Adams terms. And for Adams, the reason acceptability does the job and probability doesn't is because probability is a relation between sort of a proposition and something else. So propositions get probabilities, and then propositions can kind of figure as sort of in conjunctions and disjunctions and negations. Whereas acceptability sort of doesn't attach to a proposition. So the acceptability of if A then B is a little bit of a misleading term, actually, because there's no thing if A then B that has an acceptability. It's rather that we've got this the sentence that we're doing something with that's not picking out a proposition that has a property, but doing something else, and we're calling it the acceptability of if A then B. But what we really ought to say if we were sort of using all our names to pick out objects and not talking in this weird way is something like the conditional acceptability of B on A or the Kaufman conditional acceptability of B on A rather than the acceptability of this thing, if A then B. So I think it's not the word that's the acceptability that's doing the work. It's the idea that acceptability is not a relationship between a proposition and anything else. It's a funny way of picking out conditional probabilities. So, does that help?
Yeah, I think so. So, yeah, somehow the left-hand side has got to become very fine-grained, however you do it, except that
right.
it's not necessarily a proposition. But somehow you get the numbers on the left-hand side, and they have to be exactly as numerous as the things on the right-hand
right.
side. So, yeah, I suppose stop thinking of it as acceptability attaching to a proposition, keep the right-hand side away.
Yeah. And I take your point about the result being stronger than what I've stated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. David. Oh, was that a finger?
No.
Okay. I'll put you on the list. David.
So a very basic question. I'm wondering if you could push the unification of the indicatives and the counterfactuals right back to the beginning. So we started not with Ramsey with the conditional probabilities, but with the idea, add P to our stock of use, reason away, and that's why the indicative conditionals go with the probability of B on the supposition that A.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we have, well, the counterfactuals are like the conditional probability except weighted by the partition.
Mm-hmm.
And can you translate that back to, so when we're counterfactually reasoning, we do something to our stock of beliefs and reason away. What do we do to our stock of beliefs?
So we hold fixed a background sort of a set of background ideas. So our ideas about sort of who Holmes is or what the causal structure of the world is. And then sort of imagine, given each background possible background state, given each background state, we add A to our stock of beliefs conjoined with that background state. So I've got several stories about how the world might be deep on some deep structural level. And sort of according to each of those stories, I can add the antecedent to each of those stories, and then adjust each story.
So we partition by the causal possibilities, and then we do the original Ramsey thing within each one.
Right, and then we're done.
Okay.
So that would be kind of the counterfactual way of reasoning, and the indicative way of reasoning is like the counterfactual way of reasoning, but with an extra step. So in that case, I've got each sort of deep causal story about how the world can go. I add B to each of those deep causal stories. And then after having adjusted each of those stories, I adjust my opinion about the stories overall. So I say, All right. Well, I know it would be the case, according to this story, sort of, were A to be true, and I sort of do that for each story. And furthermore, I know that if A were true, then this story would be a lot less likely than I think it is now.
Is that necessary to account for the indicative reasoning? I mean, in a way.
Oh, right, I see.
There's no need, looking at Ramsey and the conditional probabilities, to partition into all the causal possibilities and then
right.
do the adjusted weighting.
Right.
Why not just say that's just a mathematical fact?
Right, I see.
About the way you can decompose unadjusted correlations, but that's all we, I mean, that's all we needed to think about to get the indicative judgment.
Yeah, I see this. There's a worry that I'm making it too complicated. I'm doing all this monkey business in the middle when all I needed to do was not partition at all and just add to my stock of beliefs. And I actually, I kind of like that better. I think I'll change my mind. Yeah.
Peter.
Thanks, Rachel. That was a great paper. I like the way in which you kind of unify the probabilistic and truth conditional approach through the imaging function. That's sort of very nice. Just a very small point about the way in which you align the Adams thesis with indicatives and the Kaufman with counterfactuals.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of sometimes the counterfactuals, there are some interpretations of counterfactuals that go with the Adams thesis. You know, when we're thinking about counterfactuals that enter into, say, decision making, there's a kind of backtracking reading of them
mm-hmm.
which conforms to Adams. So I think the evidential theory goes with the interpretation of the counterfactuals that conform to the Adams thesis. So yeah, I'm contemplating whether I should jump out the window. If I jump out of the window, will I get hurt? Well, there's a backtracking reading of that. Well, if I were to jump out of the window, being a cautious fellow that I am, I would put the safety net out first, and hence I wouldn't get hurt. That kind of backtracking reading is best read in terms of the conditional probability, which I think goes with the evidential theory. Whereas the Kaufman reading goes with the causal decision theory. So just a small point.
Yeah, I take that point. I'm a little bit unhappy with the way I've chopped the class of conditionals up, and I'm not quite sure what to say about it. But I'd like to talk with you more after.
Yes.
Just clarification, because the answer might be obvious to someone has thought about it this more. So what happens when they're updating? Is there, you have these equations.
Right.
And so if you do you have an updating story where they are preserved or they're not preserved, or what happens?
Yeah, so I have opinions, but I'm not sure that they're tied to anything I've said here. So my opinion is that updating goes with sort of the Adams probabilities, and you update by conditionalizing, and so that means that if you learn that A and nothing's stronger, then your new credence for B will be your old sort of Adams acceptability for if A then B, and that probably something like supposing for the purposes of planning goes by the Kaufman story. So this when I say that it means that I have to be a certain kind of causal decision theorist, not a wacky backtracking kind of causal decision theorist, but a non-backtracking kind. So suppose I were to take the following action. I want to know sort of how to update my beliefs on that supposition so that I can plan on the supposition that I take that action. I think in that case I use the Kaufman conditional probabilities, but I don't know that anything I've said entails that. Is this an answer to the question you asked, or to some vaguely related question?
No, that's partly also it was technical, whether, with your machinery, you can prove sort of whether, the equations that you want to hold, like the Kaufman and the Adams, whether they hold under some sort of updating procedure, whether there are any, results about that.
Oh, I see. So when I learn things, do I keep my old Kaufman conditional probabilities?
Yeah, I don't remember the Lewis results very well, but didn't he sort of have some of the counterexamples were about, they come apart under updating and,
Oh, I see.
Maybe worries like that, maybe, that even though you can have it for one functions, with a standard, you know, the equations fail to hold under standard updating.
Right.
That's sort of the background worry, but, you know.
Right, right. I think part of the Lewis problem is sort of, is there a stable interpretation of, let's say we can assume that sort of conditionals are picking out propositions that have probabilities, and is there a stable interpretation of that proposition and of that propositional connective that I can at least sort of hold over time as I learn things and conditionalize and do nothing else? And I think Lewis' worry is that no, there is no stable interpretation of the connective, such that I learn something, I still mean the same thing by if then, and it's actually so the results that I was pointing to show that it's a bit worse than that. So even if you allow the meaning of then to change as you learn, then you still get problems. So I think that's where that all fits in.
Okay, do we have any other questions? Yeah, Lloyd.
So probably very late. I'll go back to the epistemically impossible. I mean, what do you mean by that? Do you mean not knowable? It can't be that. The fact that it ends seems involves something which is just out of the question when you find out about it. Doesn't seem to affect anything. I mean, go ahead and reason on it. So what, do you mean probability is zero?
So I think I mean something stronger than that, which is known not to be the case.
Known not to be the
case. Right.
Yes, but many antecedents in counterfactual reasoning are known not to be the case. I mean, it doesn't seem, I mean, I'm just puzzled as to how that could affect probability. Often what we want to know is precisely what would have happened if that which we know not to have been the case had been the case.
Right. So I see the worry. I don't know what to say about those conditionals. So one thing you might do is to just restrict your attention for a moment to reasoning about things, about what would happen if things happened that we don't know not to be the case. So
that
we don't know not to be the case. So you might think reasoning from premises that you don't know not to be the case, that are possible for all you know, is sort of a big problem by itself.
Yes.
And so that's the one I'm addressing here, really. And that's the one that. So what Ramsey says is a lot stronger than that, actually. Right. So. What Ramsey says is that it doesn't make sense to. So what does he say? He says if either party believes not P for certain, the question ceases to mean anything to him, except as a question about what follows from certain laws.
But it's counterfactual. It does.
Right.
I mean, one of the most common counterfactuals in this culture is leg before wicket. Right. I mean, if the pad, if his leg hadn't been in front of the wicket, the ball. Notice we've been saying was going to get to the stump. Now, we know very well that it didn't. We know that its leg was before the wicket.
Right.
And yet we regard that as one of the most obviously true counterfactuals were the most acceptable. And I thought you were, and you're saying that you're saying there's a problem out here.
I think it's more of a problem for my account than a problem with the conditional. But So one way that people have tried to get around this problem is to say that, look, at some point, so we're referring back to some previous time, so in the leg before wicket case, we think that, so at some previous time we weren't sure whether his leg was going to go in front of the wicket. And at that time it would have been an open question whether, sort of, if his leg didn't, how easily does the cricket example go?
Well, I mean, the ball has to be in a certain trajectory, and in the umpire's judgment, mm-hmm. if the leg hadn't been where it was, the ball would have hit the stumps.
Okay, if the leg hadn't been where it was, the ball would have hit the stumps.
And in fact, that's often expressed when there's no doubt about it.
Right.
The way it's actually put is, was going to.
Okay.
Right.
I think, okay, so I've.
And yet we know that it's not true that his leg was before.
Right.
So.
Right, yeah. So I guess what Adam says when he's talking about this is that we have to refer back to some previous credence function we had where we didn't know where his leg was going to be. And we didn't know where the ball was. You might be worried there that there are cricket cases where it's really obvious what's going to happen even even before. So as soon as you know where the ball is going, you might know where the guy's leg is going to be. And that's...
The very term counterfactual reasoning are always cases in which we know very well that the antecedent is false.
Yeah, I mean, I think counterfactual is a bad name for it, actually, because of the if he had taken arsenic, he'd be showing exactly the symptoms that he's showing now, kind of examples. So that's, I take your point that you can't have an exhaustive account of conditionals if you don't say anything about sort of conditionals with antecedents that are known to be false. So I'll just say, I still don't know what to do about those conditionals, but I don't agree with Ramsey that they're nonsensical.
Just a short question on the triviality result for Hoffman. So I'm not quite sure I see how it goes, and if it really goes through, then that seems to be far more interesting than it might look like. Because so take the partition, so we evaluate this A then B, and take the partition A then B and mod A then B. That's a partition.
Uh-huh.
And if the triviality result goes through for that, then we would have to have a proof that. Because then the right-hand side becomes trivial, just by the fact that counterfactuals support more different components, it is clear that the probability of A then B must be this sum of with this partition of the kind of as Hoffman says it is. So if there is a proof that that can't be right, that would be a proof that counterfactuals don't have truth condition.
That's
any interpretation, right? We kind of. Because the right hand side, we're not using sort of Kaufman's analysis, because the right hand side is trivially true for that partition. So if there's something wrong with the. So do you think that the proof actually goes through for that partition? Where the x1 and x2 are just if A then B and not if A then B, which is not so far fetched, because kind of Lewis many discusses these dependency hypotheses. There are kind of hypotheses about what would happen when.
Right. Yeah, so I think the argument does go through. One of the things you can do is in response is reject the claim that Kaufman's thesis always holds for counterfactuals. So I think that's actually what Lewis does. He thinks that it only holds for counterfactuals of a certain sort, and all counterfactuals involving my actions as antecedents are of that sort.
Point is, I think that if you put up Kaufman's thesis, it's not clear. The right-hand side is a tautology for, given that we have more postponements for the conditional, for this particular partition. So it's not that it doesn't seem to be an option to say, well, it doesn't hold. So we only add over two things. The one is A then B. The other one is not A then B. And since we have more postponements, if you put for x1 A then B. We have B as well, and A and A and B, then we have B by the word common. So credence of B, conditional on this is just one, and on the right hand side we have if A and B. So clearly credence of A and B is credence of A and B. That kind of, and likewise for the negation that must be zero. So it seems to me that there's no option to reject Kaufman's thesis for this particular partition. And if the triviality result goes through, we would have a proof that counterfactuals are.
So that's actually that's not quite the strength of partition of claim I need to prove the triviality result. So I need it to be that taking some partition for every proposition A and B, this holds, and you've given me for any proposition A and B, I can find a partition such that this holds, and that's weaker and not.
Are there any other questions? Okay, well, in that case, we're again in the unusual position of running a little bit ahead of the clock. I suppose this is confirmation of the old hypothesis that time runs more slowly in the middle of summer. Okay. We'll start again according to the schedule at 2:15. But before that, let's thank Rachel.